have two cases for argument this morning. The first one is case numbers 25-3573 and 26-1122, U.S. versus LaMonica McIver. Mr. Fishman, take a moment and then start when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, Paul Fishman from Arnold and Porter on behalf of Congresswoman LaMonica McIver. On May 9th of last year, Congresswoman McIver, who is a member of Congress and a member of the House Homeland Security Committee, decided that it was time for her to see for herself and hear for herself how ICE was running a very controversial, newly reopened detention facility in her district. So she went on using the authority that she has under Article 1 of the Constitution, Section 527 of the DHS Appropriations
Act. Serving any time for rebuttal.
Well, I apologize, Your Honor. I told the clerk 3 minutes, but I should have brought it to the attention of the court. My apologies. Under Article 1, Rule 10 of the House, and Section 527 of the Homeland Department Appropriations Bill, she came to Delaney Hall with two of her colleagues.
You're familiar with the fact.
I don't understand, Judge, but the reason that matters, and I don't mean to interrupt the court, of course, is that from the moment she got there at 1 o'clock in the afternoon or slightly thereafter until she left slightly before 4 o'clock, she was there to perform oversight of ICE and DHS.
So,
and because she was doing that,
I disagree with the claims that out of that 2.5 hours, whatever it was, that there was a 68-second pause.
There was not a 68-second pause, Judge Ambrose. There was something that happened during 68 seconds, but our view is that from the time she got there till the time she left, she was there for one lawful oversight visit, and that under Lee, because the job of the district court is to see whether the overwhelming purpose of the legislative visit was oversight.
Mr. Fishman, let's imagine a hypothetical. Let's imagine that a congressman goes in to a facility and he comes across a teenage girl and gropes her. Is it because it's only 68 seconds out of 2 hours of oversight that you would say the speech and debate clause would protect the groping?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And as the Supreme Court said in the Kilbourn case, and it was reiterated again in Johnson, there are extraordinary circumstances during a legislative episode, but no more than it would be if that Congress...
All right, well, let's talk about the video here. The government says, and we've watched the video, the congresswoman is not in the facility. She goes out of the facility when ICE is dealing with Mayor Baraka, who is not a federal official who's authorized to go into the facility. There's a dispute about whether he can go in. And the alleged assault happens outside of the facility while she's gone out. She's not inside conducting oversight. So isn't this at least as weak a case as one that I hypothesized?
Respectfully, absolutely not, Your Honor. First of all, in the hypothetical that you posed, If that could, on the floor of the House, if somebody was giving a floor on the House and engaged in the reprehensible conduct that you just described, the Supreme Court, I think, in Kilbourn would say that's not covered.
Okay, so when Senator Preston Brooks caned Senator Charles Sumner, you would say a speech and debate clause did not protect that from prosecution.
Well, he was in the wrong House. And Senator Sumner was not in the process of engaged in a legislative act at the time. He was merely sitting at his desk. And so I think the hypothetical again, and may I say, Judge, in the history of the speech or debate clause, the number of assaults, as you can see from the Chaffetz book that we cited, are actually relatively prolific. But the number of prosecutions is relatively zero. And so the idea that that would necessarily be prosecutable, it seems far-fetched to me. The House has always dealt with those issues, as has the Senate, on their own. And the Justice Department, or U.S. attorneys before there was a Justice Department, have not seen fit generally to prosecute those kinds of cases because they do involve the conduct of legislators in their own space. Where I also disagree with you, Judge, if I may, is that the Congresswoman's oversight jurisdiction does not end at the perimeter. It doesn't end at the gate. It doesn't end at the fence. She is permitted, if she had been inside the fence and had seen an ICE agent beating a detainee 10 yards from the fence, she clearly could have walked outside to see what's going on. That is within her oversight responsibility.
Okay, but Mayor Baraka is not an ICE detainee.
No, he's not, of course. But we have to take into consideration why that entire episode took place to begin with. Because you look at the speech or debate clauses, Judge, you will never see another, there's never been a case, as far as I can tell, with the possible exception of Gravel, which I'll come back to in a minute, in which the executive branch, the legislative branch, was actually doing oversight of the executive branch. And the executive branch interfered with that oversight. So that you can't look at what was going on with Mayor Baraka in a vacuum. ICE does not like the oversight. They've tried to change the policy, despite what the law says, on numerous occasions. And they did. And while Judge Semper in the district court characterized as what happened to the congresswoman and her colleagues as a, quote, inexplicable delay, close quote, there's nothing inexplicable about it. She came to Delaney Hall expecting and having a statutory right to an immediate inspection of the facility. And instead, she was delayed for well over an hour. And then instead of actually coming to give the tour, what ICE did was mass 15 or 20 armed, masked agents with a car full of munitions for an entirely peaceful episode, invited the mayor in to the premises, recorded on an ICE body cam, so they knew he'd been invited in, and then decided they were going to arrest him for trespassing on federal land. He was, so
you know what the facts are.
Right, but
you got counts 1, 2, and 3. It seems that perhaps counts 1 and 3 relating to the involvement of Representative MacGyver with Mayor Baraka are separate from count 2, in which he's attempting to get back in to do the oversight function. How is counts 1 and 3 dealing with the Mayor Baraka not, or how is that covered by speech and debate?
So first of all, Judge, our view is that the decision of this court in Lee says that you look at the field visit, if you will, as a whole. And this court sent that case back to the district court to determine whether the overwhelming purpose of the legislator from the Virgin Islands trip to Washington and New York was legislative.
We have to accept your reading of Lee to accept your interpretation of what is legislative or not here. Because in Lee, we were careful to say that the indictment itself charged the trip as a whole, and the indictment here doesn't seem to address the investigative visit as a whole, but rather discrete acts within it.
Well, that's because the Justice Department has chosen to isolate those 68
sure.
seconds. But the
Lee as a whole language seemed to rely explicitly on how the indictment was phrased. So do we have to accept your reading of Lee to find that these are legislative, or rather to affirm that they were, I guess rather to affirm that they were, too many negatives.
That's okay.
I think you get what I'm saying.
You
have to accept your reading of Lee.
You do not have to accept my reading of Lee, because what happened was when they told the members that they were gonna arrest the mayor. And the members complained that they were interfering with their oversight visit. The agents then changed their minds and decided to let the mayor leave. The three members of Congress went back inside the facility waiting for whatever inspection the ICE folks were going to give them on a tour. But that didn't happen. So they went back outside, and the agents told them now they were going to arrest the mayor anyway, even though he's now outside in the crowd. So
I think what Judge Chung is driving at is, you are trying to very much expand the time horizon that we look at. And the government is trying to focus us in on 68 seconds, but your answer now, look at it holistically, seems in serious tension with your answer to the groping hypothetical, where you said, no, we could carve out the groping from the rest of the oversight visit. Doesn't it make more sense to take the government's approach that if they charge it discreetly, we can just look at it discreetly, rather than saying we're going to look at the fraction or the ratio that was legislative?
So I think the answer to that question is no, Judge, for a couple of reasons. One is, as what I was going to say to Judge Chung first, was that they reacted to what ICE was doing, and the three members reacted exactly the same way, and they decided to go outside and see what ICE was up to after ICE had told them they were not going to arrest the mayor. That's legislative oversight. And so, and when the district court found that it wasn't, it was because the district court misinterpreted that the entire visit was a manifestly legislative act and said the whole visit was an ambiguously legislative act, which it was not. The second reason...
Whether it was well, we'll come back to that later on. Whether it was ambiguously legislative or not ambiguously or completely legislative, you still have arguments either way. One, you would say you don't consider motive. The second, you would say you do consider her motive in attempting to get back in. But let's come back to... I mean, Judge Biss, at the very beginning, gives you an example of somebody doing something outside the entry to, let's say, the House of Representatives, groping someone. And you said that can be sectioned out. Why cannot the attempt to impair the arrest of Mayor Baraka be sectioned out in counts 1 and 3 from the other 2 hours and a half or 2 hours and 45 minutes?
So the reason I responded as I did to Judge Bevis's question is because the court in Kilbourn and Johnson said that there are some things that are so extraordinary that we would not count as their being part of covered by the speech or debate clause. And that's the hypothetical I found that hypothetical to be in that category. Here, even if you get to a legislative ambiguity here, and you do look to motive and intent and purpose as the opinion you wrote in Menendez, Judge, their motive and their purpose in going outside was not to impair the arrest. Their motive in going outside was to do oversight. They said to the agents as they went, what are you doing?
Initially, that's correct. At some point, there's an attempt, arms around the mayor, etc., when he's escorted outside the gate and arrested, to do something that the government contends is attempting to interfere with the arrest. How is that governmental oversight of Delaney Hall and what goes on there?
So it doesn't itself have to be legislative oversight. I'm not saying that assault, if even alleged assault, and we deny, of course, that was an assault, but we're not saying that assault is a legislative act. We're not any more than anybody was saying in the Gravel case that leaking classified information or publishing classified information was a legislative act. It's the person who does it, and it's the context in which it occurs. And
let's say on January 6, 2021, there was a congressman who was involved in storming the Capitol. Okay? And let's say that congressman was involved and charged with an assault on a Capitol police officer, right? I don't believe there were any. But if that happened, would that then become an ambiguously legislative act? Does that fall within your, hey, the House can deal with it on its own, it can decide whether to impeach or not, the sergeant-at-arms, we need to have a hands-off approach to this?
The answer is it might, Judge, because if, for example, someone was giving a speech on the floor and somebody from the Capitol Police came in, or ICE, or another member, and pushed the congresswoman or a senator away from the podium, and that person pushed back in the middle of a speech, that's not chargeable. If the person says, come on over here, I want to talk to you for 5 minutes, and they get into an altercation, and they're still on the floor, and there's a little pushing and shoving, not prosecutable.
Okay, but maybe they're not on the floor. Maybe they're outside the chamber, and people are trying to break into the chamber. Prosecutable?
Well, so it depends what the person was doing before that, Judge, and after. There's a context to it. The questions you're asking, respectfully, are exactly the kinds of second-guessing that the Supreme Court has counseled against, because the case law is quite clear from the Supreme Court and this court that the speech or debate clause has to be read broadly to affect...
Okay, but Hunter versus Proxmire, those are statements about legislative priorities, and the court doesn't say, oh, this is ambiguous and we need to look at intent. They're like, no, defamation liability is not stopped. That's more legislative than an assault. And yet, still, the court says, no, Senator Proxmire's not doing this on the floor. It's statements to constituents
we can parse it out, even though it may be connected to explaining why he's doing some things in the Senate.
Agreed, and the Supreme Court has been quite clear that speeches to constituents that this court has in constituent service not covered by the speech, not purely legislative acts for sure, and often not even ambiguous legislative acts. But if Senator Proxmire had been doing that from in a committee room, if he'd been doing it actually on record in a hearing, it would have been exempt.
Okay. Yeah, the chamber, committee room, we can treat being maybe inside the Delaney facility like a committee room. But she's not even inside the Delaney facility.
But
leaves the Delaney facility. And the government's contention is gets involved in a fracas around Mayor Baraka.
That is their contention, Judge. But first of all, 527, Section 527.
Hey, wait a minute. That's what the film shows, too. She was involved in a practice.
There's physical contact. There's no question there's physical contact. And in a situation that ICE completely created during an oversight visit. And the problem with this case, the reason I find this case so pernicious is because ICE was prohibited from stopping her, from not giving her an immediate visit, prohibited from using any resources to do that. And instead, that's exactly what they did. And when the Congresswoman and her colleagues reacted in the way that they did, they then decided to continue by charging her with assault. And the problem is that undermines the entire purpose of the secure debate clause. If that's possible for ICE to do two illegal things, one, use resources not to give her immediate visit, and two, arrest the mayor with no probable cause and no basis to make an arrest, and they react, then what the Supreme Court said in the Tenney case comes into
play. Except there were pretrial methods for testing probable cause.
But the issue, Your Honor, is if a member of Congress or three members of Congress are engaged in lawful, constitutionally and statutorily authorized oversight, and they see something or something happens in front of them, the speech or debate clause requires that they be given that latitude. If you read, there's a quote in the Tenney case in which the Supreme Court says that legislators basically have to have should have no deterrence to their uninhibited pursuit of their office for the same reason, Judge, that there's qualified immunity for police officers who have to act on a split second. She's there to see what ICE does, how they behave, why they do what they do, and in front of her eyes, they do something that is completely wrong.
Okay, but even areas like vicarious liability have doctrines about frolic and detour. You separate out the employee who makes a side trip with his delivery van to go and, like, drop off the dry cleaning from the employee who's driving to the work site. You know, you don't hold the employer liable for the person who takes the van to go visit his mistress or something like that.
That's true, Judge, but the law, we have been very clear in this country for 250 years that the evil that the speech or debate clause was meant to avoid was not whether we're worried about people in commerce. What the immunity doctrines under speech or debate, and quite frankly for judges and law enforcement officers, all contemplate that what would give rise to criminal liability or civil liability in another context by another person, that the people who are in those particular positions, particularly members of Congress, are exempt from that liability. We've made a value judgment that it is more important to have Congress people, members of the House and members of the Senate, doing that and not stopping at the gate and having their conduct chilled.
There are certain acts that are, most acts are exempt. Certain acts, which is how this conversation all started with us, that are not exempt. And we're trying to divine the difference between the two. It would seem, although we haven't talked about count two, that that's could be significantly different than counts one and three.
Do you agree? It would be different, Your Honor.
Why?
I can talk about count two, but the reason she's outside the facility and has to get back in is because she followed them out while they were doing something. There's no doubt about why she was trying to get back in at that point. So that's a different thing. But the point I think that I maybe haven't made so effectively, in Gravel, Senator Gravel decided that he's going to publish the Pentagon Papers in a committee report. For any other person outside of Congress, perhaps, that would have been a felony, punishable in jail for a good number of years. So, but even though it was something that placed, in the administration's view, the Department of Justice's view, as they expressed in the Pentagon Papers, troops at risk, people's lives at risk, the court, the government didn't even try in the end to argue to the Supreme Court that that was not covered. So it's not the type of conduct is part of the inquiry, but it's not the entire inquiry. So there's certain conduct that could be outrageous.
I understand, Gravel, from 50-some years ago, that you can extend the speech or debate clause immunity when necessary to prevent an indirect impairment of legislative activity. The question here was counts 1 and 3 dealing with Mayor Baraka an aspect of legislative activity versus count 2, which is she's trying to get back into her job?
So my answer to that question is unequivocally yes, Judge Ambrose, for two reasons. One, the entire episode is one legislative act, and under Lee, it's covered. And two, they were out there doing oversight, and if you were in the middle of doing oversight...
You said at the outset that there are instances where it would not be covered. There are hypotheticals that would not cover it. The question is this one? And you're trying to say, okay, it's just all one package, everything gets put in, there's a presumption in her favor, but when does the presumption, is it rebutted?
So the presumption is rebutted, at least in the language of Kilbourn and Johnson, when there's an extraordinary act. Even in Johnson, where they found the selling of a speech on the floor to be, quote, reprehensible.
I'm not sure the presumption is in her favor. When I read Gravel talks about whether it's an integral part of deliberative community processes. I think if you're dealing with something like an assault, you know, presumptively the assault isn't integral. You might be able to characterize it that way, but why should we presume that it's legislative rather than require her to show that that's legislative?
Well, the answer is we have shown that.
You have shown. Right. But what the government's done is the government has said, no, this isn't integral. We can focus in on these 68 seconds and separate it out from all the oversights. And the government's not contesting that all the things that happen inside Delaney are protected. She has a statutory right speech and it's oversight. Well, the government is saying it's not integral. We can take this out. Why are they wrong?
Because what made it integral in Gravel was where Senator Gravel did it. If Senator Gravel had sent the manuscript to his publisher, it would not have been integral. He did it while he was engaged in a committee hearing that he had called for that purpose. That's what made it integral to his duties. It would not have been if he had a press conference. It wouldn't have been if he'd given it to you. It wouldn't have been if he had sent it to his publisher. What made it integral is not what he did. It was where he did it, and the process in which he was engaged when he did it. So for Congresswoman McIver, she's engaged in a manifestly and inherently legislative act. And in that context, she then has this altercation, if that's what we want to call it, that would not otherwise have been, that would might for somebody else, not a non-member of Congress, might well be prosecutable, but it's not for her.
All right. We've had you talk for a while about speech or debate. I'm happy if my colleagues want more on that, but I do want to make sure we have some time for the jurisdictional issues as well as the merits issues on the selective and vindictive prosecution. It looks to me Hollywood Motor Car seems to say there are only three situations in which we have jurisdiction for an interlocutory appeal. Bail. This isn't a bail case. Speech or debate slash immunity. We have jurisdiction to that part of the case, but it doesn't by its terms extend to this. And then third, double jeopardy, right? There are other rights. You know, speedy trial you might have thought would be covered. You might have thought vindictive prosecution would be covered. And yet...
Presidential immunity is covered.
Right. Yeah, presidential immunity. Different immunities, okay, are covered like speech and debate. But when it comes to vindictive prosecution, and presumably that applies to selective prosecution, can ordinarily be vindicated after trial on appeal. Having a talk, it's not a right not to be dragged through the trial in the first place, the way that double jeopardy is or the bail right is. So why should we not follow Hollywood Motor Car here and say she can vindicate this right on appeal, we keep the case moving, et cetera, but why is it a right not to be dragged through the trial in the first place?
So I appreciate the court's point. I actually agree, as a former prosecutor and currently a defense lawyer, that I don't really understand why vindictive and selective prosecution would not necessarily be appealed under these.
But I've read the cases, right.
And I don't think we need to resort to collateral order jurisdiction here. I think there are plenty of reasons for this court to exercise its discretion and take pendant jurisdiction over this. First of all, you just said it's not going to slow anything down, Judge. We're already here. And so the ordinary thing that would attend in a situation like that, it's not going to make this more complicated. It's fully briefed. I'm confident that the court has read all of that. And so we can address it today, and I'm certainly prepared to do that, as I'm sure Mr. Coyne is. What I would say is that this is a much more compelling case for pendant jurisdiction than the Menendez case was.
Is pendant jurisdiction available for a criminal case?
It was in the Menendez case, Your Honor. Judge Ambrose wrote an opinion in which the court took pendant jurisdiction over the separation of powers claim when Senator Menendez said the Ethics in Government Act is unconstitutional, I can't be prosecuted for it.
They didn't directly address the question of whether it could be exercised in a criminal case. So I'd like to hear your...
We've got case law that says drive-by jurisdictional rulings don't have presidential value. Since it wasn't expressly focused on, why should we go that way here?
So I'd just like to hear your thoughts, other than the fact that it has happened, maybe in a drive-by way, whether it can legally be done.
I can confident that Judge Ambrose didn't mean it in a drive-by way. but what I would say, Judge Chung, is if you look at the CTF case, in a civil case, that's out of standard, that if there are special circumstances that warrant the courts looking at both issues that are before it at the same time in that way that it should. And these two issues, for me, are entirely connected, not because the decision on one necessarily dictates the decision on the other, which was true in the CTF case, but the issue on selective prosecution is that they have picked, they've decided to prosecute a case in which, honestly, having watched the video, she wouldn't have drawn a flagrant foul in the Knicks Spurs case last week.
I found these videos very difficult to follow. There's a lot of confusion. There's a fracas, there's a melee, it's many different angles. My concern is speech into, selective and vindictive prosecution often seem to turn on facts as they come out at trial, right? And they can be vindicated afterwards. You can review the factual record. But here, you want us to rule on these things at this point, and I just don't think we know enough. I mean, I think the issues can be put to the jury. The jury can return them, but you're putting us in a position of ruling on what look like some pretty fact-specific issues before we know the facts.
Judge, I'm not, respectfully, I very much disagree with that characterization. First of all, she doesn't get to argue selective prosecution at trial. So I'm not sure what's going to come out at trial that would then buttress our argument if she were to get convicted and we were back in this court a year from now. I don't see how that possibly holds. In particular, the district court didn't think we had even mustered, quote, some evidence, close quote, and so didn't order discovery, which I think was completely wrong because I thought there was more than some evidence.
But you run into the Armstrong case on selective prosecution, which makes it really hard even to get discovery.
It's true, Judge, but here's the thing about selective prosecution. What we don't tolerate and we can't tolerate is an unconstitutional motive for prosecuting someone. Armstrong and most of the selective prosecution cases are race-based. And the problem in race-based cases, as they were in Armstrong, and you look at all the briefing in Armstrong and the District Court of Appeals opinions, it's a struggle to basically create a statistical method of regressing out when something happened. I'm not sure, by the way, it would have passed muster even under Daubert to do it that way, but that's where we are in that jurisprudence. But I don't think anybody disagrees, and the court in Armstrong itself dropped a footnote that said, If there is evidence in the record of unconstitutional motive, if there is some reason to believe that there was a motive, we don't deal with that here today. And so the question we have put to this court is that in a circumstance in which the government can't claim that it's really worried about people who assault federal law enforcement officers because it dismissed cases that were so enormously worse than this, against people whose ideology or politics or party are shared by the president and the attorney general of the United States. And here, where we have a defendant who has been a critic of the department's policies.
I get it, but the similarly situated test, I mean, there's so many factual distinctions with the January 6th defendants that I don't know that they count as similarly situated.
So, but Judge, I think you're reading the similarly situated test in some sense too literally. The goal of the test is to figure out whether person A didn't get prosecuted when person B did, and what's the underlying reason for that. Here, the underlying, I've been doing this for 30 some odd years at both tables, and when I was engaged to represent the Congresswoman, I struggled to figure out what factor of prosecutorial discretion can possibly justify prosecuting a congressperson for something that they've dismissed on hundreds of people who share the president's ideology. The only explanation I have been able to come up with, and the government offered none in the district court, is ideology, politics, and that she's a critic. And to come back to the question that you asked, Judge Chung, about why that matters for pendant jurisdiction, is that being a critic of the administration, of course, is what the speech or debate clause is also designed to protect. So you have two different issues involving the same case, the same defendant, the same actors, DHS and the United States Department of Justice, bringing this power to bear on a member of Congress, and the very reasons that the speech or debate clause exists is to prevent the executive branch from coming after members of Congress with whom they don't agree. And so they did that here in two different ways. One, by exercising whatever judgment they had that they wanted to stop this visit from happening in the way it was supposed to happen. And second, from now bringing a case where the only conceivable justification is that she is who she is and she thinks what she thinks and she votes how she votes. And that's impermissible. And I get your point, Judge. If we have to go find a Republican member of Congress who was involved in an assault during the last 17 months, because it has to be the same decision maker, Mr. Coyne argues, well, say we're all prosecuted by the Biden administration, but it's the motivation of the decision maker in her case that matters. Yeah. And you can imagine the circumstance, Judge.
What makes you think that pendant jurisdiction is a better avenue in hearing the merits as opposed to collateral order doctrine?
I don't know that it's better, Judge. I just think it's an easier argument for us to make. I think collateral order jurisdiction exists here for all the reasons we articulated in our brief.
I thought the Second Circuit did that in Myers.
They did. And so I think you can do it under either. But the reason I find this particularly compelling for pendant jurisdiction is because what the executive branch did at Delaney Hall and what they're doing in district court in Newark is exactly the same thing. They are picking on someone who is a member of Congress who does not agree with their views. And so that's the problem. And there's what other explanation for this can there be? So that's why I think the court should take jurisdiction, and that's why I think the issue on selective prosecution is so clear. If I can come back for one second, Judge Bibas, to the abuse, legislative immunity thing, we haven't even gotten yet, and I apologize for that, but the conversation has been going where it's going. I don't see how the government tries this case at all without legislative acts being part of this trial. If you read the indictment, they mention her legislative acts three times. When we get to trial, Mayor Baraka was told by victim one, the agent who swore out the affidavit against him, you're not allowed to be here. They are. They're allowed to be there because they're members of Congress and they're allowed to be there. everybody who was there that day, the Congresswoman, the other two members of Congress, the ICE agents, HSI, everybody who was there only because she was there and they were there. HSI with a car full of munitions doesn't show up to Delaney Hall every day.
That would be a tricky prosecution to present. So tricky that maybe they run afoul of it. But it seems like, why wouldn't the remedy be the same remedy anytime inadmissible evidence is offered? You can move for a mistrial. You could, if it seems willful, you could ask for greater sanctions.
Because the speech or debate clause judge gives Congresswoman McIver the right not to be tried under the circumstance, and it would be unfair, the situation in which the government has been unwilling to articulate how it could possibly do this.
And if Judge Temple were affirmed, then that would mean they're confined to these very narrow time frame and could not ask about any of the context of that 60 seconds. And so, sure, that could be very difficult, and maybe they would run afoul of it, and then they have, in fact, violated the speech and debate clause. But it seems like if Judge Semple, if we were to adopt Judge Semple's view, that that there's a remedy for that, that would not necessarily implicate the clause.
So, I think the government should have to give a better explanation. We're able to do it. That's for one. But second, if you look at footnote 14 in Menendez, I'm talking about in McDade, this court said if a defendant is forced to have to put evidence, and not chooses to, not like Senator Menendez was going to put in evidence of things that were unrelated, or Congressman McDade was going to put in evidence of prior speeches or other speeches. This is a situation in which the entire set of facts turns on why she was there. And it will be impossible for them to prosecute her with mens rea or for us to defend mens rea without alluding to, and not alluding to, but actually mentioning why she was there. Everybody who's going to get cross-examined is going to get cross-examined with that. That's not us choosing to do it. That's us being forced to do it in order to defend the case. And that's what the speech or debate clause prohibits, just as it did in Johnson. Because in Johnson, the government wanted to put in a little bit of speech, and the congressman had to put in the rest of the speech, and that didn't work for the Supreme Court. And so in this particular circumstance, I don't know how the U.S. Attorney's Office is actually planning to try the case, because the government's brief said they don't have to tell us. But there's, for me, I can't imagine our going to trial in this case and not having been forced in order to defend her fully under the Constitution. It's almost in some ways like the rule of completeness. There's no way to do this without that coming out, and it can't. And so that's yet a third reason. First, it's all a legislative act. Second, she has the right motive and intent for the 68 seconds. And third, the trial's not going to work in that way. Simply not possible for anybody to forecast how that would actually go.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Fisher.
Thank you.
We'll get you back on rebuttal.
Thank you.
We've been generous with time with you, and Mr. Coyne will be equally generous with you, too, for some of you.
Lucky you could be up for an hour.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Mark Coyne, half the United States. Thank you. Sincerely, thank you for the privilege of being here today in Wilmington, especially given the lovely weather today. With the Court's leave, I'd like to begin with two factual matters that my good
friend... Can I just ask just a general question at the outset?
Of course, Your Honor.
You've been at your job at the U.S. Attorney's Office for a long time.
22 years.
Have you come to a case where the DOJ has charged someone under 11A for a similar level of contact with a federal officer?
I don't know if it's a similar level of contact, but just recently we charged somebody for throwing an umbrella at a federal law enforcement officer.
This is somebody whose path is blocked. She's trying to get back in. On
count two. If you're focusing on, I'm sorry, Your Honor, if you're focusing on count two.
Yes. And she's just trying to, out of my way. I need to get back and do my job. I struggle finding anywhere where, that I know of, where somebody's been indicted under 111A for that type of contact.
So, Your Honor, and there's obviously the speech or debate clause component, I think, of that question, and then there is a selective prosecution or vindictive prosecution component of that question. I'd like to start...
He's walking outside Congress, and there's a group, there's a hearing supposed to start, and there's a group of people who are demonstrating, and they're impeding your way, and you eventually go, I got to get in there. I can't imagine that that congressperson would be indicted for an assault for trying to get through a crowd and perhaps using not sharp elbows, just plowing through. That doesn't seem like an assault.
So, Your Honor, on whether it's an assault, whether she was acting with the intent to assault, that's a quintessential factual issue for trial. For me, the speech debate clause issue is whether we would have to introduce any evidence that would necessarily call into question, a legislative act. And so, as Your Honor's pressing the question, in order for her to meet her burden under the speech or debate clause, it's on Representative McIver to demonstrate that that was a legislative act. And I'm going to take respectful issue with characterizing the desire to get back into the facility so she could continue.
Well, that's what she was.
I
mean, that's her actual act. She did go back in.
She did go back in.
But I want to
contrast, say, for example, looking at videos, her conduct with the conduct of the other two members who were present on the site. Representative Menendez did not use any physical force, so far as I could tell, to reenter the facility. And Representative Watson Coleman also did not use any physical force to reenter the facility. And there's...
My question goes broader than that. I don't know, is there any case that you know of where anybody else has ever been indicted for this type of thing?
I don't want to say every case is too generous, Your Honor, but this is not a typical case. I would certainly admit that. I would hope not. I mean, charging a sitting member of Congress is a very consequential act, not something that Ralph took lightly in this case, and certainly not something that I'm taking lightly defending that choice here today. It's a little farther removed, but then Judge Alito's opinion.
Your indictment counsel said she pushed past V2, that's the ICE officer, while using each of her forearms to forcibly strike V2 as she returned inside of the secured area of Delaney Hall.
And the video, that describes what the video shows, right? And then there was a confusion below. Judge Semper was initially confused about who victim two was because there's a separate, effectively altercation where a different agent shoves the representative, she shoves him back. Judge Semper wanted additional briefing to see whether that was that, believing that was victim two, that officer, whether there was a viable speech or debate clause challenge. Victim two is not that person. Victim two is an agent who had his back to the representative, and she does essentially body him out of the way.
Victim two, the district court found that the V2 was not purposely impeding McIver. Is that even right?
You know, I don't...
Under our case law?
I don't think it's relevant in the sense of you're certainly not looking at Representative McIver's, well, she's bringing to play what her motives actually were in doing that by raising that argument. I don't think his motives are necessarily relevant. But the context here, though, is in response. The scene shows what he was doing was simply trying to help preserve an aisle so that the mayor could be returned inside the facility while being handcuffed and to prevent others from interfering with that process. What the videos also show...
My guess is you don't believe that her action at that point in time was completely legislative, manifestly legislative.
I don't think it's manifestly legislative. In fact, I'm going to go the other way.
Ambiguously legislative to the point where we could take into account her motive for getting back in.
Your Honor, respectfully, I don't believe it was ambiguously legislative. I concede that it's a closer call on count two than it is for counts one and three. I certainly will concede that, but I believe...
What makes it inalterably not legislative?
Use of physical force is never never covered by the speech or debate clause. That's our position. We're not asking for some special exemption or special exception, as my good friend says, and quite frankly, my former boss at one point says. We're not asking for some special exception. We think that's a straightforward application of the Supreme Court's precedent, this court's precedent. There's a quote from Gravel that I want to bring to the court's attention. While the speech or debate clause recognizes speech, voting, and other legislative acts as exempt from liability that might otherwise attach, it does not privilege either senator or aide to violate an otherwise valid criminal law in preparing for or implementing legislative acts. That's Gravel 408 U.S. at 626. Our prosecution theory, we maintain, fits squarely within that language from Gravel. It doesn't privilege assaultive behavior.
Could I contours of how you understand what is legislative unambiguously not legislative, let's put it that way. Do you agree with your colleague's assertion that even if outside the facility observing DHS activity is legislative?
I don't actually agree with that, if only because it seems to me the farther you get away from the actual facility, the purpose that for which the oversight inspection is supposed to take place, I'm not so sure that it is. But we didn't litigate that. Or
I understand that. I'm just trying to understand your theory of what is or is not legislative. So you think there is some tie to the actual physical location that legislative oversight couldn't also take place outside observing the activities?
It's a tough question under this court's precedent, right? Because Lee and other cases, and for that matter, Judge Amber's opinion for this court and Menendez do talk about oversight and how and it can be expansive. Information gathering can be oversight. My point here, though, is not even assuming that observing outside the facility, even assuming observing outside the facility can qualify as oversight, and then, even though it's not oversight of what's going on inside Delaney Hall, rather it's supposedly oversight of what is a classic executive branch function, which is not at all in the sphere of Article One. This is a classic Articles function, which is executing the laws of the United States. It's one thing, as the videos show, to be observing, literally observing. And as I think, I don't want to speak conclusively for this because the videos, there are videos, and we haven't obviously had a trial, but for example, Representative Menendez seems to be standing back. Forgive me for emphasizing, but he seems to be a bit removed from the fray in contrast to Representative McIver and Representative Watson Coleman, at least Representative Watson Coleman initially.
To your point, it's difficult. The questions I'm asking are purposely sort of in that gray area because I'm trying to gauge where your principles will land in these gray areas. So if to your point, if she were observing but just standing very close to the mayor and they said move, and she wouldn't move, would that require inquiring into her motive? Is she not moving because she wants to observe, or is she not moving because she's trying to resist?
So
would that inquiry violate the speech and debate clause?
So I think under Menendez, assuming that observing outside the facility rather than inside the facility counts as legislative act, and I'm not conceding that it does. I'm just saying it's a much tougher question for us. But assuming that it does, or at least it's ambiguous, you're very much into the second step of the Menendez inquiry, which is it ambiguously legislative? And then we go into analysis of a bunch of things, including the purpose.
And your colleague suggested in a footnote that Bogan might mean that our test in Menendez is incorrect.
Well, and also quoted, I think, Bruin for one step too many. I know in all candor, the Solicitor General's office took the position in an opposing cert in Menendez that there was no need to get to the second step, and actually that it's not necessary. But the Solicitor General's office also defended the ultimate result quite forcefully in Menendez.
The step wasn't necessary, but I'm just inquiring, is it consistent with Bogan? I mean, and are we bound?
I am not going to criticize any member of this court for reviewing And Judge Ambrose, that also applies, and I hope you didn't take offense to my invocation of drive-by jurisdiction. I do want to talk about drive-by jurisdiction. Although I will say this, is one of the Jesuits who taught me in high school told me, even Homer nodded. But I'll get back to this, which is, I think this area of precedent is, there's a lot of it over many, many years, over centuries now. And I certainly can understand why, looking at Lee, right? And even to some degree, looking at the language in McDade, this court concluded, Judge Amber, you concluded on behalf of the court, unanimous opinion, that there is a difference between something that is manifestly legislative, always covered, can never be prosecuted, can never be the basis for a prosecution if it's manifestly legislative. In addition, as Menendez noted, if it's manifestly not legislative, which we submit covers the conduct here, there's never a speech or debate clause question. And then, but if it's somewhere in between, forgive me, I keep hitting this and I'll lift it up. If it's somewhere in between, then it's the second step inquiry is necessary. And I understand why the court went there, Menendez. I do. I can't say that it is the department's position, at least at the Solicitor General's office, that there really needs to be a step inquiry, because that's not the position the Solicitor General took in opposing cert in Menendez. But I certainly understand why this court read those precedents that way, to cover acts that are ambiguously legislative, to look at that and then go into this more nuanced, fact-specific inquiry. I don't know if that answers your question sufficiently.
Well, from 10 years ago, Menendez has been followed, so you have
James,
inherently legislative or manifestly legislative, inherently not legislative, and then ambiguously legislative, and if it's ambiguously legislative, you can take into account, among other things, the person's motives.
I agree, Your Honor. And James reinforces that, right? And James, although James is applying the Virgin Islands analog, I read James as essentially applying the speech or debate clause test as this court articulated it in Menendez. And so I'm not asking this court to reconsider that. This court, that these are controlling precedents. Our position is the conduct we have alleged, yes, and we don't have to prove up a trial, for example, why Representative McIver was there. We don't have to do that, right? And so much of my good friend's argument hinges on the supposition.
Even in your indictment, you concede why she was there.
Well, we concede, but we don't have to prove. We don't even have to submit the indictment to the jurors.
You don't have to prove it if you concede it.
We don't have to prove. Well, we certainly concede that she was entitled to be there. She was entitled to inspect the facility. We're taking no issue with that. Yes, she was.
Would it be legislative if she instructed, let's say she had a bodyguard or something, and said, you push that guy out of my way?
I don't think it would be. As I understand the controlling precedent on the speech or debate clause, it will cover aides stand in the shoes of the member of Congress. And so if the member of Congress would be immunized against prosecution for the act in question, for example, if Senator Gravel was too hoarse to speak and asked an aide to read into the record many passages from the Pentagon Papers, that aide would be protected. But if it's not a legislative act, the aide gets no more benefit than the senator or the representative does.
Count three, it's not clear to me what conduct we're supposed to be examining. It might even look either duplicitous or multiplicitous. The only force I see alleged is with regard to victim one and victim two. So in that sense, maybe it's multiplicitous, but if it's assault, there appear to be multiple victims, which maybe that's duplicitous. It's very hard for me to understand what is the conduct charge and against whom, and what am I evaluating as far as its legislative nature?
So, count three, the misdemeanor count, the most, the least serious of the counts. It's a misdemeanor count, not a felony count. At the same time, as I understand it, it covers essentially all of the efforts to hinder, impede the arrest of the mayor. And on that score, I just have to be candid with the record. And what I understand the trial proves, what a trial would look like here, those impeding efforts started even inside the gate. The videos show that at one point, it's when The mayor is told if he doesn't leave, he will be arrested and told several times, and then finally told, okay, I'm going to arrest you. It's not just that Representative McIver says, hell no, hell no. She grabs on to the mayor, as I remember the videos, and is preventing at that point the execution of the arrest. That is taking place inside the secure facility, right? And so if one operates under the assumption that anything inside the facility is very much within the inspection mission that the representatives were there for ostensibly, you know, that our proofs do talk about that. But even there, I argue that interfering with an arrest is never a legislative act, no matter where it occurs. That is our through line through this. And we're not asking, as I said, not as my good friends suggest, we are not asking for some special exemption. We are trying to apply faithfully Supreme Court precedent in this area, including Gravel, and this court's precedent, including Menendez and James.
Let me turn for a moment to the selective or vindictive prosecution. What is your argument on whether there's even jurisdiction?
There is no jurisdiction over those claims, and I'd like a couple reasons. I think McDade answers this. Then Judge Alito's opinion for this court said, this court will not consider additional claims along with a speech or debate clause claim unless those additional claims independently satisfy the strict Cohen test, as the court has interpreted, especially in the criminal context under Cohen, right? And so, and Your Honor had mentioned Myers, the 1980 Second Circuit decision. Myers is cited 9 years before Midland Asphalt. And Midland Asphalt, Justice Scalia wrote that opinion for the court. Midland Asphalt emphasized how strictly the Cohen criteria had to be applied in the criminal context. And I think Judge Easterbrook wrote, I think, a very fine opinion in Shock. We cited that in our brief. Judge Easterbrook's opinion explains why you can't bring it's inconsistent with Abney, the passage that we've relied upon heavily in our brief. It's, for that matter, I don't believe Judge Easterbrook's opinion, and she cited McDade, it might have, why it's inconsistent with what McDade held in terms of what other issues this court can consider. And mind you, McDade made clear that the court had jurisdiction to address complaints, similar to the ones that are being raised right now about how the trial would look.
If there were an attempt by whatever government authority you have, whether it be the federal government or state government, local government, it makes no difference, that I don't necessarily care if this person is convicted at trial. I believe, however, that if somebody you're doing a vindictive prosecution or you're selecting someone out, especially someone in Congress, I want to see them under the pressure of having to deal with this, both the financial and the personal pressure, stress that one goes under. And that'll be enough for me to get my pound of flesh. You can't consider that before trial? You're saying you have to wait till after trial, you have to go through all that trial and spend all that money and then have an appeal, assuming you lose?
Well, Your Honor, I think, and if we're still talking about appellate jurisdiction, I mean, obviously the district court can consider those allegations before trial and can determine whether they're...
I'm just asking a practical question. I mean, in that hypothetical I gave you...
I understand.
It seems as if you're picking out a particular individual, perhaps that individual has opposed whatever policy the governmental authority has, and you're saying that before trial, there is no way to try to stop that in its tracks.
Well, there is. I mean, in the Court of Appeals, there is no way. We think that's a straightforward application of Hollywood Motor Car and the other Supreme Court precedents we've cited in our brief. And on that score, we did brief this in our brief. We didn't just simply incorporate by reference the pretty extensive motion papers. But we think Hollywood Motor Car makes crystal clear the vindictive prosecution claim is not itself appealable under the collateral order doctrine.
Is it possibly a mandamus possibility?
There might, I mean, mandamus does require, right? It's either a writ of prohibition or a writ of mandamus. It's either requiring the court to do something or forbidding the court from doing something. And I suppose there theoretically might be mandamus relief available if the record is so stark, so starkly clear that this is a case of vindictive prosecution. And I would want to, I don't want to commit the United States in perpetuity to that position, Judge, but mandamus, the standard is really strict. Whether it's a writ of prohibition or a writ of mandamus, is extraordinarily strict. But I stand right here. I can't say that there might not be an extraordinary set of circumstances where the extraordinary writ would be available.
There's no doubt it's extraordinary. In my 26 years, I think I've only seen it maybe once.
It's it is an extraordinary relief to seek, especially when the United States seeks
it. Also, an extraordinary case.
It is, but I want to get back to Meyer. Okay. And although it's not quoted in the briefs, I do feel like I do want to raise it. As I pointed out in Meyer, which is, and I don't mean any disrespect to your hypothetical, Judge Ambrose, but as I understand my good friend's arguments that the other cases, what I've been calling in my brief, I call the targeting claims, that those are really important, weighty issues, so you've got to hear them. And Myers certainly lends some support to that notion, right? It does. Myers is decided 9 years before Midland Asphalt.
Debate and also separation of
power. Yeah, separation of power. Schott, by the way, is a speech or debate clause case, too. That's Judge Easterbrook's opinion much more recently. There's also an opinion we cited in our briefs, and I'm getting into independent appellate jurisdiction, Wittig from the 10th Circuit. That opinion is by then-Judge Gorsuch, holding that there is no pendant appellate jurisdiction in criminal cases. But back to this. Myers says what it says. Midland Asphalt comes down. Much more recently, admittedly in a slightly different context, the statutory 30-day deadline for filing a notice of appeal.
Have jurisdiction under collateral estoppel or what?
I thought, my reading of Myers is it's tough to figure out what Judge Newman, forgive me for using his first
great
name.
Great judge.
Wonderful judge, and when I clerked on the Second Circuit, we knew him by his initials, J-O-N. But it's for me, looking at it, it reads like it's a bit of a, we're going to apply a looser collateral order doctrine standard, just because these are really important issues and we're not so worried about a tsunami of litigation, because how many members are there at any given time who could be prosecuted, who could be raising speech or debate clause claims. If that's what Judge Newman was relying upon, and an extraordinarily gifted jurist, that cannot be squared with Midland Asphalt and any of the subsequent Supreme Court cases on the collateral order doctrine, especially in the context of criminal cases. It may be invoking or relying on pendant appellate jurisdiction principles, and so I want to turn to that here. And I think my point on that is, the Second Circuit back in 1999 in a per curiam opinion said this, essentially, and I'm going to quote, even if they were correct, the quote begins at, were correct, that the substantive issues in this case are important, that fact could not create jurisdiction in this court where there was none otherwise. There is, perhaps unfortunately, but nevertheless inexorably, no such thing as interesting question jurisdiction. The site is Cody Inc., the town of Woodbury, 179 F3rd, 5256, Second Circuit, 1999. It's a per curiam opinion. It is quoting a memorable line from a dissent by Judge Jacobs in 1995, the concluding sentence of which was, there's no such thing as interesting question jurisdiction. I don't mean that to be pejorative. I understand, Your Honor, the concerns that you're raising. But the test is extraordinarily strict on the collateral order doctrine. And so then moving to pendant appellate jurisdiction, which I, if the court will give me a little bit of time to address. My problem with relying on that one line, that one sentence in Menendez, and I think Judge Chung, you said, and you alluded to this, and that there's no comprehensive explanation for why there is why the pendant appellate jurisdiction criteria have been satisfied, or even why it's available in criminal cases. I don't think it is available in criminal cases, at least not when a defendant is trying to evoke it. And there are at least four circuits that so hold. And this court has never...
Was there a motion?
There certainly was. I want to get to that, Your Honor.
And that was just granted in the discretion of the court?
I don't know if the order actually establishes that. What the order says is we are limiting the appeal to these three issues. The first issue was obviously speech or debate clause, obvious jurisdiction, right, under Helsowski. The second issue was what the order refers to as the separation of powers issue, right? But as I understand the separation of powers issues, and I did attach, this is in the reply and further support of our motion effectively to limit the appeal, I attached then Senator Menendez's briefing in opposition to the government's motion to limit the appeal, as well as the court's order. That briefing acknowledged, pointed out that at least in one of the circuit, the D.C. Circuit, and actually potentially there's more. When I took a dive into this preparing for oral argument, I think there may be as many as two, at least one other circuit, had held that where the separation of powers claim of the type that then-Senator Menendez was asserting was one that turned on the rulemaking clause. And the argument was that if a particular count of the indictment turned on interpreting a Senate rule. And Senator Menendez was right. The D.C. Circuit had signed off on a defendant's interlocutory appeal under the collateral order doctrine under those circumstances. So, Your Honor, Judge Embro, and I'm sorry I may be taking more time on jurisdiction than I should. Reading what Judge Cross's order for the motions panel says, I read it as saying there is appellate jurisdiction under the collateral order of doctrine under the first two issues. The order then went on to say we are exercising mandamus jurisdiction over the venue challenge to one of the counts of the indictment, then goes on to say we are declining to exercise pendant appellate jurisdiction over everything else, citing the very passage in Abney that we're relying upon and citing the very pages of McDade that we're relying upon. And so that gets back to my other point, which is this court has not, in a comprehensive opinion, held that there even exists pendant appellate jurisdiction in a criminal case, right?
I think the Supreme Court case you're talking about, which post-dated Myers, talked about that the collateral order doctrine is meant to be very narrow, but not much more than that, especially in criminal cases.
It's supposed to be very narrow. Look, and Fell is another example of, and there it's right, the compulsory medication.
Simple. You don't want everybody having an interlocutory appeal in a criminal case because you would have that ad infinitum, but that there are certain extraordinary cases where it is allowed. We mentioned those at the outset under the order doctrine. There's another one called medication.
But the test requires, among other things, that there is no way to vindicate that right on appeal. And again, going back to Hollywood Motor Car, they are
those can be vindicated on appeal, right? Double jeopardy can be vindicated before a trial. Excuse me.
Double jeopardy, of course. If the claim is that my current prosecution is barred by a prior prosecution that resulted either in a judgment of acquittal or, for that matter, a conviction, yes, that can be appealed. That's Abney, right? But we take Sixth Amendment, the denial of the Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial. That's not appealable under the collateral order, right? And there are a lot of important rights, and I think Judge Bevis was alluding to this earlier when my friend was up at the lectern, that there are a lot of important criminal rights that just are not, I don't gainsay that they're important, but they are not, they can still be vindicated. The alleged deprivation of them can still be vindicated in an appeal from a final judgment.
And so what happens if a lot of people in Congress are indicted for acts or former persons in administrations are indicted for acts?
So, Your Honor, the Supreme
Court... They have to go through trial and go through all that time expense, and then only then if they lose appeal?
So, Your Honor, a couple of things. There's sort of the legal issue, and then there's the factual issue. Let me start with the factual issue. That hypothetical presumes that people like me would bring charges for vindictive reasons.
I'm not saying you.
I understand, Your Honor, or would follow orders to bring vindictive prosecutions. I'm still here. So is my colleague, Mr. McCarron, who's the longest tenured AUSA in our office. He's been an AUSA since 1995. So, but legally, the Supreme Court has made crystal clear you're not supposed to look at case-specific circumstances. It's the category. You look at the whole category of claims. And that's sort of the doctrinal pushback I'm giving you, Judge. And I want to be clear. I understand why you're asking that question. I do deeply appreciate it, and I hope a hypothetical like that never comes to pass in this country. And I will do everything in my power individually to ensure it doesn't, at least in the District of New Jersey.
I trust you.
Well, I appreciate that, Your Honor. I've covered pretty much all I wanted to say about the collateral order doctrine and pendant appellate jurisdiction, but actually one more thing. Even if this court were to definitively hold, and if the court does decide that pendant appellate jurisdiction does apply in criminal cases, right? I'm advocating against that, obviously, but I think you would need to issue an opinion explaining why that is so, in part because four other circuits have held that it's not, at least not when a defendant is trying to invoke the doctrine. That's one thing. The second thing is, in writing that opinion, if a defendant can raise pendant appellate jurisdiction to piggyback otherwise unappealable claims onto something that is appealable on an interlocutory basis, then of course I, as a representative of the United States, so long as I have the privilege of being a representative of the United States, will be able to benefit from that too. That was an issue. That was an issue that came up in the second of the United States v. Bergeron opinions, as I know my good friend knows. His name was at the top of the brief. We submitted in that. We were trying to challenge a grant of a severance, and that severance order also told us which counts we were supposed to try first. This court issued a jurisdiction defect inquiry. We submitted a 30-page response explaining why we thought we could pursue this. We invoked pendant appellate jurisdiction. We cited the United States v. Maker. Judge Jordan's response in his opinion for the court in a footnote said, in essence, the government says that Maker already decided this. We have never so held in a precedential opinion. We need not decide that now, because we are granting the government relief for other reasons. This court has never, in a precedential opinion, explained why, if pendant appellate jurisdiction doctrine does apply in criminal cases, why it does apply in criminal cases. That's one thing. Second thing is, assuming it does, you want an example of an opinion that highlights how stringent the criteria are for pendant appellate jurisdiction? Judge Bibas, your opinion in U.S. v. Brace, a civil appeal. In fact, I just don't see how, even if pendant appellate jurisdiction exists in a criminal case, and there are many others, and we cited a plethora of cases confirming how stringent the pendant appellate jurisdiction criteria applied. I don't understand how the facts that and the legal principles that govern the selective prosecution, the selective enforcement, the vindictive prosecution claims necessarily are either inextricably intertwined with the speech or debate clause challenge here, or that you would need to reach those latter ones in order to provide meaningful review of the speech or debate clause claims. That's what the test requires, as this court has said it time and again. And that's what the Supreme Court said was necessary in Clinton v. Jones in exercising pendant appellate jurisdiction over Paula Jones's cross appeal from then President Clinton's direct appeal. So that's pretty much all I have to say about appellate jurisdiction. Forgive me, I've been an appellate litigator for the U.S. United States for most of my career. About 22 years now, about 18 plus as an appeals guy, but that is a fascinating issue for me. Unless the panel has further questions for me, I ask that this court affirm the order below denying the speech or debate clause claim. I ask that the court dismiss, for lack of appellate jurisdiction, all of the other claims that that Representative McIver is raising on appeal, including the claims that are surfacing here at oral argument, that effectively evidentiary issues, we were entitled to some sort of preview of the government's case. That too is not under McDade. That's not a tool right now either. And that is, as we all know, a speech or debate clause case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Fishman, I believe you reserved 3 minutes.
I did, Judge. I don't know how to multiply that by the amount of time before I take it. I want to test the court's patience. But look, let me just start first on the pendant jurisdiction question, just because that's where we ended. I haven't read the briefs in the Menendez case in several weeks.
Menendez, what it said is, we have jurisdiction of the speech or debate clause under the collateral order doctrine, citing McDade. We have pendant appellate jurisdiction over the separation of powers claims, citing a case called CTF Hotel Holdings from 2004 from our court. And we have jurisdiction over Senator Menendez's request for petition of mandamus under 1651A. Yes.
Oh, so thank you, Judge. I have read the opinion within the last 24 hours. But the briefs, my recollection is, Mr. Coyne made all of the exact same arguments to your panel in the Menendez case that he made just now. And nevertheless, you and your colleagues on that panel...
That was my recollection.
...took jurisdiction. And so while I appreciate his second bite at the apple, we are where we are on that question. So let me start there. Second, with respect to the assault issue, because Mr. Coyne has now doubled down on the assertion in his brief that use of force is never a legislative act. That might be right, but we're not arguing that an assault is a legislative act. Senator Gravel didn't argue that the publishing of classified material was a legislative act. Where he read it made it a legislative act. What he was doing makes it a legislative act.
I worry that you are blurring the distinction between the immunity and the evidentiary privilege.
I don't think so, because if you do something that would be prosecutable, give rise to criminal liability in another context, if any member of Congress walks into a bar, sees an ICE agent, and gets him, it's not covered. And that's not what the law is. If the member is in the middle of doing an inherently, manifestly, or even ambiguously legislative act, it's covered. And the problem with Mr. Coyne's reliance on Gravel is that in his brief, he says that the quote from Gravel are acts threatening the security of the person or the property of others. What Senator Gravel did was threaten the security of people. So the idea that somehow assault after 250 years has magically disappeared from the speech and debate clause can't possibly be based on that sentence, because Senator Gravel was immune under those circumstances. Same thing in the Kilbourn case. The legislators in the Kilbourn case directed the sergeant at arms to go arrest somebody, which interferes with the security of a person. They were immune.
Can you point to any case where a member of Congress was being prosecuted for assault, battery, or another physical crime, and a court held that the speech or debate clause barred that prosecution?
No, because the department's not bringing those cases, Judge. That's the problem. The issue is the inference that I draw from the absence of cases, despite the long and kind of sordid history of members of Congress either being involved in assaults between each other or among each other or with other people. The fact that the department isn't bringing those cases and hasn't brought those cases when some of those assaults were way worse than this suggests that the conclusion is not that this is fine, but that they shouldn't be bringing them and they should be dealt with in the House, with the Senate.
There's another conclusion, which is juries don't like these cases. Most departments don't want to put up cases that are likely to lose in front of a jury. If this department wants to roll the dice on that, it's prerogative. I don't know that we have to draw your inference. I mean, silence is always ambiguous, almost always.
I get that, but it's not that there's silence. It's just that there are two Supreme Court cases in which the security of people or risk of harm to people was actually at issue.
And yeah, but Pentagon Papers was not about a physical act. It was about fears of downstream physical consequences.
That's fair, Judge. But the fact is, the line of dictum on which Mr. Coyne hangs his hat is just that. It's dictum in a case where we don't really know what they meant. And by the way, if you look at the paragraph in which that quote is contained, the paragraph is talking about the distinction between legislative aides and members. It's really more about that than it is what members themselves might be liable for. And so in that sense, it's not actually the right way to go. Let me quickly just jump to the problem is, here's the problem. And Mr. Coyne said it at the beginning of his argument. We just charged a case where a guy threw an umbrella. We know of a case in which a guy was arrested for throwing a ham sandwich.
I think it was a submarine sandwich, but look at the idea.
In North Jersey, Judge, we would call it a
that
hero.
That was in D.C., right? And
yeah, exactly.
They later dropped it.
It went
and was acquitted.
Yes, they tried that case, Judge, and therein lies the spectacularly terrible thing about the argument that Mr. Coyne is making. I've known Mr. Coyne for a long time. He's a very trustworthy fellow. That's fine. I actually promoted him to be chief of appeals. Today, I may regret that, but back then, it seemed like a very prim decision. But this court is not sitting here in a vacuum. The selective and vindictive prosecution jurisprudence has turned since the Armstrong case on the presumption of regularity. I don't quarrel with Mr. Coyne on this case, but it's very clear from the conversation at Delaney Hall on May 9th of last year, when the special agent in charge of HSI got off the phone and said, Todd Blanche said to arrest the mayor. These calls on cases involving members of Congress, we can't be naive about this. They are not made in Newark. Mr. Coyne wasn't involved in the charging decision, and as much as I may like him and may think he's smart, this court cannot base its decisions on the bona fides or good faith of particular prosecutors in particular moments at a particular time. That's the way this works. And the problem in this case, and I can't emphasize this too strongly, is, and I'm at the risk of, once again, Judge Bibas just dipping slightly into the facts. From the moment they got there, the goal of ICE was to thwart. There's no other inference to be drawn. Thwart their constitutional exercise and statutory exercise of oversight authority. And then, and by the way, Mr. Coyne talked about, well, something happened inside the gate. They tried to prevent the U.S. the first time. That's covered. Now we're back to where they're going to start talking about conduct that's actually during the legislative act, if that's where they are. But they did everything they could to thwart it. And then he wants to rely on one of the most malleable statutes in the federal criminal code, Section 111A. Judge Chung, six verbs, right? It's not just assault. It's impede. It's interfere. It's obstruct. If I can do what it did and in fact, do something that then draws them outside, and then the U.S. Attorney's Office has unfettered Article II discretion, as he described it, to bring a charge. And as Judge Ambrose has said now at least two or three times during this argument, the result of that is that a sitting member of Congress has to endure this entire process. And yes, maybe you're right, Judge Bibas, maybe they will acquit in the end. And I certainly hope that happens if we get there. But we should not get there, because the combination of those things are exactly why the court should exercise pendent jurisdiction over the selective and vindictive prosecution case claim. Because if you put all of those things together, what this does is it gives the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security the ability to interfere, impede, obstruct, thwart members of Congress who are doing exactly what they are allowed to do by law. And then when something happens, say, oh my goodness, this was an assault. She threw a ham sandwich. She threw an umbrella. She threw an elbow. Where are we, Judge, in 2026? That's the government's defense to this patently awful prosecution of a sitting federal congressperson. This court has the power under the speech or debate clause to say, no, that's not right. What she was doing was authorized, and what she was doing was lawful, and what she was doing was constitutional, and because you did something during that executive branch, when she was there to see what you were doing, you can be prosecuted for that.
Thank you, Mr. Fishman.
Thank you, Judge.
We'll take the matter under advisement. I want to thank both counsel.